This program is live and local. It's your connection to local performances. Good afternoon. I'm Kevin Kelly. On the program today, I will be talking with, coming up, the great tap dancer whom Gregory Hines called perhaps the greatest tap dancer who ever lived. His name is Savion Glover. He is going to be performing a program called Soul Sanctuary at Sangamon Auditorium in Springfield Sunday evening, and he'll be my guest later portion of our program today. First up, however, with the Danville Symphony Orchestra, Saturday night is going to be a group of eight brothers and sisters out of Canada who collectively are called Leahy. They are, of course, all members of the Leahy family, and play and sing and dance a mix of music that sort of defies category. But it is certainly high energy, as you are about to hear. I will be talking with one of their members coming up in just a few minutes. It's live and local on FM 90.9. Stay tuned. We just heard a tune that is called Mission, performed by the eight-person band of brothers and sisters called Leahy out of Canada. They're going to be performing with the Danville Symphony Orchestra on a concert Saturday night at 7:30. Music director and conductor Jamie Swirling helping to preside over those proceedings. And on the phone with me now is one of those eight brothers and sisters. Her name is Aaron, plays the piano, sings in the band, does some dancing, and I appreciate your joining us. Thanks very much.
You're welcome.
I guess I'm especially intrigued, as I'm sure many people are, by one line that I read in your biography for the group, and that is the one that says, "A large family raised without a television on a farm in the small town of Lakefield, Ontario, Canada." And assuming others listening may not be familiar with your story, I wonder if you wouldn't mind just sort of telling the beginning of it anyway.
Sure. Well, our parents are both musicians. My dad played the fiddle and my mother played the piano, and she step danced and she sang. Dad's from Ontario, Canada, and mom's from Cape Breton. And they met in Ontario, and they had a band for many years before even they had, Dad had a band for many years, I think 35 in total. And so when they started having children, eventually the children were able to, do a little step or play a tune, and they would sort of bring them onto the stage to have as a guest, you know. And eventually that just turned into more and more involvement from the kids, and which then eventually became kind of a new group just by demand in the local area, and then nationally, and then further than that. But at a young age, we grew up on a farm, a beef cattle farm, and mom and dad realized that the kids, I guess they would have had four at this point, were watching television, and they didn't particularly think that that was conducive to learning music and learning anything, really. And so they just decided to remove it from the house, and they just took it out, gave it away. And then we never had a television after that, except for the Olympics. They would rent a TV so that we could watch the Olympics. But it just created an environment that was one in which we had to come up with ways of entertaining ourselves, which often would be in the form of music and other things as well. But it was significant because we, of course, had this time to devote to music and just live as a normal family on a farm in Ontario.
Well, the normal part sounds okay, the family on the farm in Ontario, until you add all the music going on. Which has especially with all of you playing music. I mean, I'm in a family of five siblings, and although each of us did a little bit in music, my dad didn't, and mostly three of the five siblings didn't, and I'm the only one doing it now, so it doesn't always work out the way you guys have worked out.
No, I guess not. Some people have said we're genetically forced to do it. I think that it was a combination of our parents certainly had gave us that kind of direction, and in combination with the fact that our environment was such a musical one, in that mom and dad had friends who were musical as well, and they would come to visit, you know, regularly, and so our fun, not just music, but whenever we would have social gatherings, they would never be without some kind of music being played, you know, live music in the living room. And so that was just what was normal to us. And you can't help as a child in that environment but just pick things up without even trying. So, you know, myself as an example, I'm the youngest girl, and I grew up listening to my sisters all, and my mother in particular, play the piano. And I remember having a couple of lessons in this style of music, and that was it. It was beyond that, it was mimicking, and it was having the opportunity to play with a brother or a sister who was asking you to play with them because, you know, they, that's what they wanted. And, of course, with so many, that's another factor that I think contributes a lot, is that you had made so many siblings, 11, that what was normal, what was what was happening with all of those children. And again, even, you know, performing on stage is for us something that felt like a belonging or a home. It's, at a very young age, we all started performing at, you know, 4 and 5. So the stage was a comfortable place and has always been a comfortable place. So when I say normal, I mean that's what was normal to us. We also went to school and we played sports and we did those kinds of things as well.
And I note that you're a bit of a soccer player.
We are all soccer players.
Oh.
Yep. We all we live on a farm and we have this big field in the front of our house, and Dad converted it into a soccer field and a baseball. He put up a baseball diamond. And so it was, yeah, that was so common. And we all played in leagues and things like that. And yeah, big, big sports family.
I wanted to play for our listeners another off of, actually, does this come off of one of your live albums, A Love Never Known, or is this maybe just from a separate live performance?
It's on our live DVD and our live CD, yes.
And this shows off a lot of the vocal talents of the group. Do most, if not all of you, do some of the singing?
Mostly the girls, my sisters sing. My brothers sing on occasion. For example, our Christmas tour, we all sing a piece together, and so they join us for specific numbers, but it's usually just the ladies.
And who's the star singer in this particular song?
That would be Denise. Well, she, you know, you could have, if that's the live performance, now that I think of it, I would be singing lead on that.
Oh, so this would be
yeah,
you.
Yeah, we have
here,
two
then.
Versions. Denise sang the version on our Lakefield CD, A Love Never Known. So I was a bit confused there. So it's me.
That's fair enough. Well, then, all the more appropriate. It's it's Leahy, the family, performing here on Live and Local. They'll be with the Danville Symphony Orchestra Saturday night at 7:30. The song is called A Love Never Known by the family called Leahy, Aaron Leahy is my guest on Live and Local and was also featured vocalist there. And Aaron, I was a little confused when you introduced that and thought maybe it was the version that had Denise on it. And I'm looking at the list of family members on your website, and I note Donald, Siobhan, Frank, Agnes, Doug, yourself, Angus, and Maria, and Denise doesn't show up there.
No, we have what we would like to think as a major and a minor system in our family with so many. We recruit them up and down. No, it's actually different members throughout the years, depending on family responsibilities. Their own children have participated more or less. And Denise, I guess during that time of our live performance, was tending to her family, but she has been participating full-time now for probably about 6 or 7 years. So.
Okay, so she'll be with you in Danville then?
Yes.
Okay. I count at least three fiddlers and maybe a fourth who plays fiddle with you sometimes. Do you sometimes have multiple fiddle tunes, meaning tunes for multiple fiddles?
Yes, we do. Yes. Danelle is the lead fiddler in the group, and Angus and Doug also play some lead as well. And we do group fiddling quite a bit in our show as well. So it's a little mini quartet at times. I play fiddle. Actually, most of my sisters play the fiddle as well. But in the show, it's usually my brothers, and sometimes I play with them.
And you're the main pianist.
That's right, yep.
Yeah, so we heard you. So you were singing and playing piano in that last song.
Yes, I was, yeah.
Yeah, that's always a... I always am amazed out that I know many people do it, play guitar and sing, play piano and sing. I'm barely could walk and sing. but probably could and have managed that. When you perform with symphony orchestras, as you're going to do with the Danville Symphony on Saturday, what does that change about the dynamic, if anything, the dynamic within the family, having that massive backing band for you, as opposed to when you just play on your own?
Well, other than being a little bit distracted by the musicians, we are a good distraction, that is. We're a large group ourselves, and so when you add a symphony to that, it is a very full stage, and we really have to place our instruments well. So I end up, as a pianist, sitting right beside usually the concert violinist in that whole section. So it is it's a real joy for us because we are, of course, performing for our audience, but also really collaborating and feeding off of the energy of the symphony. And we don't do too many symphony shows, so the additional musical component is a thrill for us. It's such a full sound, and there's so much energy and excitement in it as well. So it's a real treat for us.
Jeremy Swirling, who's the conductor of the Danville Symphony, when I asked him, you know, if he wanted to participate in our conversation, he said, well, this is really Leahy's show, and we're just kind of the backup band or the backing band. And so this is will be kind of a different sort of show for them. On your in your biographical material, I was looking at some of the awards you've won, including for Best Country Group. You've won an award for Folk Jazz Instrumentalist. They describe you, the Danville Symphony does in their material, as a Celtic group. And I wonder how you think of yourselves, if you even throw yourselves into any particular category?
Well, over the years, we've been asked that question, and it's very difficult to answer. We would say we just play Leahy as a category. But certainly, our music is in the Celtic tradition, roots music. You know, it crosses many, many lines because of our influences, and it was our main influence was in the Celtic tradition. But our parents played. My dad had a dance band, so he was familiar with the popular music, and we were hearing that as well. And we all, most of us, took classical lessons as well later, after the initial training, from our parents. And so, you know, we had a lot of exposure to various styles of music in the whole bluegrass world, and I think that that's what comes out is there isn't one predominant style. And even in terms of fiddle music, growing up in Ontario, it was similar in that there wasn't one main genre or style, whereas, you know, in Ireland, you can tell an Irish fiddler versus a Cape Breton fiddler, or a, you know, those are very distinctive styles. Ours is kind of emerging, I suppose, which is a combination of French Canadian influence, Irish, Scottish, plus all of the classical and popular influence along the way. So it is what it is, but I would say it fits in categories like Celtic, like roots, like world music.
Well, since you mentioned classical roots, I think we will go out with a tune that will, like these other ones, be on the concert Saturday that does have its roots in classical music. It's featured as for lots of different instruments at different times and different arrangements, but here it's you all play it in essentially the traditional way, and this is the Chardash of Vittorio Monti, which is always usually a violin feature. And I wonder is this always played by the same fiddler in your band, or do your family members switch off on this tune?
It's always played by Donnell. Yes.
And Donnell is actually one of the brothers.
That's right, yeah. He's the oldest boy in the family, and he's our lead fiddler.
I asked that because I had a girlfriend in high school once named Donnell, but she spelled it differently.
Okay.
but the same pronunciation. Well, it's a pleasure to talk to you. It's fun to hear this music, and it'll be fun for us to hear this adaptation of the Chardash. Leahy will be performing with the Danville Symphony Orchestra Saturday night, 7:30 in the Dick Van Dyke Auditorium of the Danville High School. And Aaron Leahy has been my guest here on Live and Local. You can get more information on the whole band by going to leahymusic.com. That's spelled L-E-A-H-Y music.com. And Aaron, thanks very much for taking the time.
My pleasure.
It's the band called Leahy performing Vittorio Monti's Chardash. They will be playing that tune and many others with the Danville Symphony Orchestra Saturday night at 7:30 in the Dick Van Dyke Auditorium at Danville High School. Jeremy Swirling will conduct the proceedings, at least when the orchestra is involved. And you're listening to Live and Local here on FM 90.9. I'm Kevin Kelly. Coming up, a conversation with tap dancer and choreographer and producer Savion Glover. Support for our show today comes from the Corkscrew Wine Emporium, 203 North Vine, Urbana, with wine tastings on Saturdays from 3 to 6:30 p.m. in the Bouvon Wine Bar. This Saturday, it's a baker's dozen 13 wines from the Marketplace Selections portfolio, followed from 7 to 9 by the music of Lamont Parsons. Details are on the Corkscrew's Facebook page. That was Savion Glover, actually, from one of the numerous YouTube clips that you can find of him dancing, either by himself or with some other dancers, or as the cartoon figure of one of those little dancing penguins from the film called Happy Feet, which he choreographed. And Savion Glover came to prominence when he was all of 12 years old, I think, in a Broadway show called The Tap Dance Kid. Other shows that he was in early on in his career, Bringin' the Noise, Bringin' the Funk. Before that, Jelly's Last Jam with one of his mentors, Gregory Hines. And also with Gregory Hines and Sammy Davis Jr., he was in the film Tap. He's been in lots of others as well. He is an Academy Award-winning choreographer for Happy Feet, and has established his own teaching studio, and he is going to be performing at Sangamon Auditorium at the University of Illinois at Springfield Sunday night at 7 o'clock, a program called Soul Sanctuary. And it is my privilege to welcome Savion Glover to the show.
All right. Thanks for having me, Kevin.
So the inevitable first question is, how does a young kid decide to start tap dancing? How did that work for you?
Well, I was, my mother actually signed myself and my two older brothers up for just basic tap classes. Started off as a musician. I was playing the drums in a band, and we were playing at a benefit concert at a place called Hines and Hatchett Dance School, and it was there that my mom signed us up for dance classes. I guess the coincidental event about that particular night was, coincidentally, I saw Lon Chaney and Chuck Green perform at this benefit, and little did I know, years later, become my teachers and pioneers of the art, so... It was a very special evening.
Did you say Hines and Hatchett?
Hines and Hatchett, yes. Hines like Gregory Hines, Hatchett like Frank Hatchett.
Yeah, was that Gregory Hines' school?
Yes, it was. Him and his brother Maurice were partners with Frank Hatchett, and it was called Hines and Hatchett Dance School.
And did you encounter him early on then?
Sure. He frequented the studio every now and then, and all the kids would see him, but I didn't, establish a relationship with him until later on.
Yeah, until after you'd really kind of got going. So what was it that, so your parents took you, so that wasn't necessarily a voluntary thing, but you must have grabbed onto something pretty quickly. What was it that appealed?
Well, tap dancing in the beginning was just fun, something fun for me to do. As we were living in Newark, New Jersey, and we had an opportunity to go to New York every Saturday and go to these dance classes, so that was an event in itself. But it wasn't until later on where I was blessed and fortunate enough to meet these great people, Henry Letang and Jimmy Slide and Chuck Green and Chaney and Diane Walker, all these great people of the dance. It was then when I realized that I was into something that was more than just a form of entertainment, or more than just tap classes per se. So it was later on that I actually began my relationship with the dance and actually fell in love with it.
Was it partly the sound? Was it partly the energy? Was it partly the sheer fun? Was it the music?
It was basically the commitment to the people responsible for doing it. I realized that, it was more about the people and being able to carry on the tradition that they had established in dance, tap dance, being a form of communication and a form of storytelling and a form of expression. Again, I would later on acknowledge their contribution to the dance and fell in love with it that way. Of course, I I love everything about the dance, the sounds, the looks, the moves, and everything like that. But I am more in love with the people responsible for the progress of the art form.
You got your professional experience awfully early, like age 10 or something like that?
Mm-hmm.
How did that get started? Did the right person happen to see what you were doing? And
yeah, actually, Frank Hatchett arranged an audition for me to audition for the Tap Dance Kid. And that was my first introduction to show business. And then after that, after Tap Dance Kid, all of my dancing appearances were arranged or influenced by these great men.
And your show that you're doing right now, Soul Sanctuary, is, at least as I've seen it described, largely a tribute to some of these great guys who you met so early.
It most definitely is. This is a piece that speaks directly to their contribution and allows the audience to hear, once again, through dance, my homage and respect and thank you to them. This is a very personal, one of my favorite dance productions that I have created thus far.
Tell us a little bit about how it looks. For those who might be interested in going, is it you solo on stage?
It's myself and a very good friend of mine, Marshall Davis Jr. And it's just the two of us, basically. And it's not a lot of sets or props. We do establish some. Images of the people we are referring to and paying homage to. But other than that, it's basically some sort of dance sanctuary, if you will, on the stage.
So he is also a dancer?
Yes, Marshall Davis.
Mm. And would you say he's a protege of yours? Or?
No, not at all. It's just my partner. He's Marshall was one of the last students of Steve Kondos, the great Steve Kondos. So we are connected in that way through him. But no, he's definitely not a protege.
You've talked a lot about the origins of tap dancing, and as I was reading about them, this was actually something I wasn't aware of. So I'm guessing that many of my listeners will not be aware either. Sort of a mission of yours to take tap dancing back to its roots. You want to talk about those roots a little bit?
Well, I mean, different cultures have their different roots and particulars about what tap dancing is and where it comes from. There's a story about Gregory Hines and Fred Kelly back and forth about where dance or tap dance started. And some say Africa, some say Ireland or the Irish started it. And so, I mean, it's all a matter of opinion, like a lot of our history. As far as what I do, I believe that it is a form of communication. It does go back to roots leading to Africa and wherever there was a lack of tools used to communicate. There was this sense of percussion that was able to be heard and better understood versus, the literature or American language. So it's not that I'm on a mission to take it back to the roots, but just allow people of this generation and for generations to come, just allow them to understand the dance as tone, vibration, and sound versus a visual thing.
You described it as percussion, which, of course, percussion can be anything that you hit, I suppose, or any sound that results from hitting. You mentioned early that you played drums as a kid.
Yeah.
And I understand that a number of other tap dancers also were drummers, at least at some time in their lives.
I mean, not only that, when you talk to the great jazz musicians, whether they're piano or drummers, it was common, you know, to have a tap dancer. A lot of the drummers got their licks from the tap dancers. So we were always running sort of neck and neck as the music and the dance evolved.
How long did you play drums yourself?
Oh, I started playing drums, I guess, when I was like 3 years old, so my mother tells it. You know, I continue to take shots at it every now and then.
Oh, even now?
Yeah, sure.
And is that sitting at a drum set or playing all kinds of different percussion to...
That's sitting at a drum set. It's just sitting at a drum set.
Do you imagine parts of your feet corresponding to different parts of a drum set?
Well, yeah, not only corresponding to the drum set, but also I imagine my feet can be any musical instrument or therefore anything that can establish a sound, whether that's an ocean or leaves crumbling, cameras, shutters, taking pictures, tuba players, harmonica, piano, violin, anything that can create a sound is what I established to produce through my feet.
Do you, I read a description, for example, that the, you know, the heel of the foot might correspond to a bass drum or another part of the foot to the snare drum.
Is it as simplistic as that
or not really?
I'm sorry?
Is it as simplistic as that?
Yeah, I mean, it's you know, how one decides to establish their instrument and play that or through their feet is their individual preference. But that was something that that was written in a book that I had, My Life in Tap. But those points change. Like sometimes the, you know, the heel can be, you know, a tom-tom or a snare. It's not necessarily those parts that you have that you relate to are solely what they are. You know, they can be different things at different times. The front part of the foot can be a cymbal, or the front part of the foot can be a cowbell, or, you know, whatever. These things are left up to the imagination, and it's our, you know, duty as a musician to try and allow one to hear those instruments or those nuances or those tones as distinctly as possible.
It's interesting that you referred to yourself as a musician. Do you think of yourself more as a musician than as a dancer?
At times I do, yes, because I set out to play music. But sometimes as a choreographer, when I am find myself, you know, choreographing or doing choreography, I tend to lean more towards the dancer in me versus the musician. But I try to establish a medium between the two. But solo, when I am alone or dancing in a production like Soul Sanctuary, it is definitely an approach one like a musician.
Do you have music behind you during this particular production? Or are the two of you the music?
Yeah, well, for the most part, we are the music. We have three musical pieces, but two of them are just some, you know, ambiance, just some sounds that I've created with various, you know, instruments or whatever, and then the other tune is a tune by John Coltrane, Resolution. So it's just three musical selections. Everything else is done. Tapapella.
That's a good word. And we're talking with Savion Glover, whose show called Soul Sanctuary is going to be at the Sangamon Auditorium in Springfield Sunday night at 7 o'clock. He'll be joined by Marshall Davis Jr. for that show. You mentioned choreography and thinking perhaps more as a dancer when you're doing choreography, but in creating choreography, I imagine that actually, I've seen read descriptions of how you think about this a little bit. That you have to, that you listen to the music that's going on, obviously to the rhythm, and take inspiration from that. And I wonder if you could talk about that process just a little bit, if it's talkable.
Well, yeah. I mean, it's, you know, when I have a lot of music that I've been listening to, or you know, throughout the course of my life, and when it's time to put a dance to that music, the choice is, are we going to pick an instrument and be that instrument, or are we going to be an additional instrument to the music that is already existing? So, and then sometimes we go back and forth, try to play in both. But it's a challenge for tap dancing, the approach to tap dancing that I do, it's a challenge to do choreography nowadays, because again I want to be the instrument as much as I can, but I also understand what it is to be a choreographer and to paint various pictures for the audience. So I play, I try to play both sides. I try to first, you know, satisfy myself and with my approach, and then I also think about those who may be watching.
In this particular production, as we said, paying tribute to some of your both mentors and people who've inspired you in some way or another, but you also are, and you could describe it better than I, seem to be trying to both modernize tap and keep it real, as you say. And I wonder what that means exactly.
You know, these are terms that the kids have come up with. But, you know, I mean, look, dancing has been here. This approach to dancing has been here well before I exist. So it is just my proud and honorable duty to be a part of the tradition and carry on the legacy of these great men and women who have contributed such wonderful energies to the dance. I can't change the dance, because if I change the dance, then I'd be doing something different. But my goal is to, you know, continue on the same path as one like Jimmy Slide or Gregory Hines or Chuck Green or Chaney or any of those cats, you know, just trying to, again, bring awareness to the dance. I guess when we say keeping it real, it's just keep it, stay committed to the dance and you know, don't allow the distractions of where the dance can be or what the dance can be. Try not to allow those things to throw me or the dance off course, particularly today, you know, in today's world or whatever, there's quite a lot of accessibility to changing what a lot of the art forms are. So it is my duty and again privilege to maintain what the dance is, what it was introduced to me as, and just stay, you know, on that path.
Savion Glover will be performing Sunday night at 7 o'clock at Sangamon Auditorium at the University of Illinois at Springfield. The program is called Soul Sanctuary. He'll be joined by Marshall Davis Jr. and 7 o'clock show. You can get more information on the concert and tickets and so on by going to Sangamon Auditorium. Actually, Googling that, best way to do it. And it's been my pleasure to talk to you on the show today. Thanks very much for joining us.
Okay. Thank you, Kevin.
And here's a segment where Savion Glover, with Zane Mark, talks about some of his mentors, some of the great tap dancers. This comes from the show, Tony Award-winning Broadway show, Bring in the Noise, Bring in the Funk, from 1996. Glover was about 22 or 23 at the time. And so you will hear, well, you'll hear what you'll hear.
Hollywood, they didn't want us or something. They wanted to be like entertained. See?